The future of digital asset mining calls for top technical talent. Enhance your ASIC education with Foundry's hands-on courses. Led by veteran industry instructors, Foundry's three-day mining intensive and five-day mining technician academy programs cover a range of topics, from identifying issues and troubleshooting common hardware failures to coursework covering Bitcoin's global impact. Open to enthusiasts and professionals alike, visit www.foundryacademy.com to learn more and sign up for the course that's right for you. Hello and welcome to the end of the year's mining roundup with CoinMetrics. I'm joined by Parker Merritt, customer success and contributor to State of the Network. Really excited for today's conversation. We're going to be going over 2022's mining numbers, which there's a lot to go over right now. And Parker, to be honest, we have something we have to discuss at the beginning of the show, which is Core Scientific filing for Chapter 11 this morning. But first of all, good morning and welcome to the show.
Yep. Great to be here. Appreciate you having me back as always. Yeah. Core Scientific right out the gate. You know, I thought they were getting a bailout from one of their investors. I saw that news a couple of weeks ago. There was some sort of alternative financing being pitched, but looks like that didn't work out, huh?
Yeah, it does not look like it worked out for right now. So just some details before we jump into it. Everyone should go look at CNBC's reporting on it from Mackenzie Sigalos, who is just a fantastic reporter in the Bitcoin space. But from what we know right now, they are opting to file for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. They're going to continue operating the firm, mining Bitcoin. They have about 5% of the network's exahash, which is about 50 Bitcoin per month. They are not able to pay a lot of debtors, and there's a decent amount of unsecured creditors right now. So if you're looking for more information about that at the moment, I would refer you to CNBC or the Miner Mag for more details about Core Scientific. But definitely a sour note to start the morning off on, and there's been a lot of sour notes recently. That being said, we have some great data to go over, and who doesn't love mining metrics? Parker, I'm going to kick it over to you for a little intro on what we're looking at today. You guys run State of the Network, which is a fantastic newsletter from CoinMetrics. I think it's one of the longest running data newsletters in crypto. I've been reading it, I think, for at least since 2018, and everyone should go subscribe afterwards to this. And you yourself do about 4 mining roundups per year or per quarter on for State of the Network. And here we have the end of the year one, 2022. So I'll boot it over to you. What are we looking at today?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So a lot of this is pulled from our more recent mining specials. We've got everything from, you know, some of your fundamentals like hash rate and fee market revenue. And then we do a little bit of a deeper dive on some of the mining pool dynamics, especially around Poolin, which is, you know, a top 5 mining pool that collapsed in Q3, as well as some other interesting statistics around the mempool. So lots of stuff to cover today. Hopefully will be interesting.
Okay, just for housekeeping, Parker's going to bump me along whenever we go to the next slide. We have a decent amount of slides to go through. I think about 33 slides. So it's going to take most of the hour. We'll probably speed through the ones that are pretty typical, like hash rate and difficulty, the ones that people know off the top of their head. But there's some other ones that deserve a little bit more time. So we'll go through those. Bear with us. We'll also have a podcast version of this later. So you have to jet in the middle of it. Feel free to jump onto our audio feed and grab it there, or just watch it again on our YouTube channel. It'll be up there right after the show concludes. So we'll be here for about the next hour. But we'll start off, Parker, handing it to you for hash rate and difficulty.
All right. So first up, I get to eat my words here at the end of the year. Naturally, you know, about a year ago, we were on the podcast doing some end of the year predictions, end of 2022 for hash rate. And I kept on calling for over 300 exahash. Unfortunately, the market turned against us in many ways. So it looks like we sort of topped out here around a 30-day average of 265 exahash per second. And we've since drawn down to around 250. You know, the good news there is that miners are getting a little bit of relief with a downwards difficulty adjustment. Just recently, 7.3%, I think it was a downward tick, which is the biggest downward adjustment since the Chinese hash rate exodus in summer of 21. So yeah, you know, some good and some bad, depending on how you look at it. Hash rate coming down a bit and might continue to come down as we continue to see bankruptcies. But of course, that relieves some of the pressure on miners' bottom lines as well.
Yeah, I think the star of the show for this slide here is anything after September 2022. Beforehand, like, it was just basically always difficulty going up. We saw a little pressure come off everybody during the summer after the Terra Luna fiasco and Bitcoin's price going down. But for the most part, you're really looking at that pre-October or October increase in difficulty, which put a lot of people in a tough spot. And as we'll get to in a second, a lot of people have questions about where that difficulty adjustment came from, that upwards difficulty adjustment that was so severe. And then the other one to look at is the end of the year. We had that decrease, which was the second largest since the China mining ban, which is another significant one. We don't have in this one the most recent difficulty increase, which is about 3%. Didn't move the needle much for anyone there, but we'll just note that. I'll bop over to the next slide and we'll keep talking about this very similar subject.
Yeah, next slide. Basically the same thing, just kind of zoomed out. Always good to zoom out and see, you know, what's the long-term trend. Of course, you know, even though we're down a little bit, we're still very well near all-time highs for hash rate. And you can kind of see over the history of difficulty changes, there's quite a bit less volatility in terms of the difficulty changes as well over the long-term trend, just as we start to see more commoditization of hardware. So again, always good to just step back and zoom out a little bit. But I would say, you know, based on your comment, you know, where did that sort of big upward difficulty adjustment a couple months ago come from? We do have some ideas about how that might have happened. This chart here is actually featured from, you know, a friend of Coinmetrics and a friend of Compass as well, I believe, Data Always, really great sort of on-chain analysis. And this basically takes a look at sort of Bitcoin's hash rate plotted up against Ethereum's hash rate. Obviously, we had the merge in September, and you know, at that point, we had a lot of rack space that was, you know, looking for somewhere to go. So, you know, there's a lot of theories out there on where this big uptick in Bitcoin hash rate might have come from. But one theory that we've been running with is that a lot of this rack space was essentially repurposed as miners started to yank out their GPUs. You know, some of that might have gone to Ethereum proof of work forks or Ethereum Classic, but a lot of those coins just did not have sort of the yields that miners were used to. So we think a lot of that rack space might have been repurposed for Bitcoin mining, you know, putting up ASICs. So just one theory on where that hash rate might have come from. I don't know if you have any thoughts there.
Yeah, one actual quick thought is I misappropriated this actual chart for our own mining memo newsletter about 2 weeks ago. I think I only cited Coinmetrics. So apologies to Data Always. Love your stuff. Everyone should go follow him on Twitter if you can and go subscribe to his newsletter. Some amazing insights. I think from this chart itself, it is interesting to see that there, in retrospect, it actually made sense, right? But I hadn't thought about it until I was actually speaking with Data Always via DM and we were talking about how it makes sense that people would take their ASICs or Ethereum ASICs off shelves and put a Bitcoin ASIC in their place because Ethereum mining was so much more lucrative for most of 2021 and going to 2022. You'd, of course, keep your Ethereum ASIC on the shelf. Even if you're a Bitcoin maximalist, you're probably a profit maximalist at the end of the day. So you're going to keep that Ethereum ASIC on the shelf. And once we saw those ASICs just turn into bricks, people put Bitcoin ASICs on the shelves. I think some other ideas here, of course, is like there was some energization in Texas during this time, September, October. ERCOT, which is a big energy provider, grid regulator, I should say, in Texas was really slowing down projects going online during the summer because they were worried about grid stability. And they started greenlighting things in September and October, which I think contributed to a lot of this exahash coming online. So that is my takeaway from this chart. But again, some great info here. I'll keep moving along.
Yep, absolutely. And one other thing I'll add, you know, obviously S19 XPs are kind of coming online, you know, making deliveries around that time as well. So yeah, definitely a convergence of factors, but lots of interesting things to look to there. Okay, so here we have our sort of cumulative miner revenue 2022 year to date. So where things stand right now is miners have earned around $9.23 billion in block rewards and a paltry, again, $138 million in fees. So again, would always love to see those fee numbers come up a little bit. But yeah, just to compare to 2021, the year-to-date revenue on, you know, December 31st was around $16.75 billion compared to what we have around 9.23 billion so far this year. So things are definitely looking, you know, a little bit worse than 2021, obviously. And you can sort of see the rate of change in terms of the accumulation of revenue slow down substantially as well. So just sort of a high level view of revenues that miners have earned over the last year here.
I do love this. And just a little teaser, mining revenue derived from transaction fees has been sort of a conversation in the Bitcoin space for a little bit, with some people bringing up the fact that maybe Bitcoin should have more revenue for miners, or just revenue in general from transaction fees. And tomorrow we're going to have an episode from Layer 2, which is a new Bitcoin Layer 2 project with an attempt actually to bring more transaction fees to Bitcoin, to Bitcoin miners. So stay tuned for that. It's a little teaser for that show, which we're recording today and hopefully publishing tomorrow. We'll keep moving along here, looking at some more revenue charts.
Yeah. And again, this is sort of a more granular view of, you know, the previous chart, which is, instead of looking at it, you know, cumulative year to date, looking at it quarter to quarter. And you can really see here that the majority of the revenues for 2022 came in first and second quarter here. First quarter, we had around $3.5 billion. Second quarter, around $2.5 billion. You know, but by this quarter, we're barely managed to scrape together $1 billion in revenue. And that's across both block rewards and transaction fees. So Q4 has been especially tough compared to the last few.
Yeah, I actually am glad that we have this chart up. And one thing I want to just think about as a mental exercise is the amount of VC capital, or capital in general from different parts of the market, that flowed into public miners. And then you can probably get a little percentage based on that, or if you just kind of use it as a heuristic and think about how many dollars private miners garnered, and then think of like the actual revenue that you can capture in the Bitcoin space. And I think that's a cool thing about Bitcoin, is you know how many Bitcoin are coming per quarter. You don't know the price of those Bitcoin, but you can generalize and say, like, well, we're around this benchmark, around $20,000 per Bitcoin. We know this many Bitcoin are going to be produced this quarter. Then we can get a general feel for what revenue is going to be for the industry. And then look at the private money flowing into the industry, and you start asking some questions. The thing I'm bringing up really is Core Scientific, which has about $1 billion in debt. You know, if you look at how much Bitcoin you can mine per quarter across the entire industry, what was it, 1.5 billion per quarter for this last quarter? Mm-hmm. You start looking at things like this, and you're like, I think there was some malinvestment or bad investment from capitalists into the mining sector over the last 2 years. Because even like 4.5 billion I'm seeing in that October to January 2021, that's a decent amount of revenue. But for the capital that I've seen flow into the mining sector, I mean, you saw some raises into the nine or more figures, which is a lot of capital. So that's my only thought on this one. I'll keep moving along to the next slide, though.
Yeah. And of course, you know, the underlying metrics that sort of power these revenue projections is our hash price and hash value. So, you know, when you really get down to it, what matters the most is your daily revenue per terahash per second. And you can see here, we've got it plotted out both in the Bitcoin denominated value, which obviously reacts a little bit more rigidly to our difficulty adjustments here, and then the USD denominated value as well, which is a little bit more subject to Bitcoin's price fluctuations. So you can see with, you know, that downward 7.3% adjustment, we got a little bit of relief in terms of the Bitcoin denominated revenues, but just because of sort of the continued downward price trend, that hasn't translated into an increase in terms of dollar denominated revenues. So again, just another fundamental metric to sort of monitor the health of the mining ecosystem, and hash prices as bad as ever.
Really is. I don't want to dwell on this chart because it's pretty depressing, but it is fundamental to the space. Like, if you're just learning about Bitcoin mining, maybe you just came across this channel for the first time, this is one of those metrics to really grapple with for a little bit and figure out. And there's not a lot of inputs into it, so it's not crazy, but for miners, this is what they look at to understand where their profitability and their revenue is for mining Bitcoin. Okay, up next, we got more fee market stuff, and I already gave my little spiel on the fee market, so I've kind of told you everything I have to say about it at this point, but I'll hand it off to you.
Yeah, again, just a couple of different views of some of the more basic fee sort of health measurements. So in 2022, fees are definitely up, at least as a percentage of miner revenue. Beginning of this year, it was hanging around 1%. Then we bumped up to around 2% this summer and reached almost 3% just this past month or so. So fees are definitely sort of increasing relative to, you know, the this year's sort of minor revenue numbers. But if you hop over to the next chart, you can see we're still very near historic lows. You know, in past cycles, the fee percentage has reached as high as 15 to 25%. So, you know, we would still expect to see this a lot higher given, you know, the recent kind of bull cycle. But unfortunately, we just haven't seen that translate into increased fees for miners. So, yeah, lots of sort of propositions floating out there as far as how that can be increased, whether that's merge mining, drive chains, you know, additional applications built on top of Bitcoin. So, yeah, we'll definitely see if this picture changes in coming years as fees become a more important part of Bitcoin's security budget.
Yeah, actually, I have more to say about this. I lied. This is one of my favorite topics. So I think for the audience, what is useful here is to understand the difference between Bitcoin as a money network and Bitcoin as an application layer. And there's a lot of debates if Bitcoin should be one or the either, or if it can be both. And to date, Bitcoin developers and the community have mostly decided that Bitcoin should be a money network. You shouldn't have any applications built on top of Bitcoin because that makes it hard to decentralize the network by running your own node. For example, if you have a bunch of applications running on top of it, well, just think of how often you have to update your PS5 and how much data it takes. It's not really going to work as a money network at that point because it won't be as decentralized. There's other people on the other side of the spectrum who think that it should be an application layer, that you should be able to build DEXs or prediction markets or stable coins on top of Bitcoin. And they think that this will actually help Bitcoin become a more healthy, robust network, mainly because you increase your bottom line revenue from fees that goes to miners by increasing the number of applications on chain. And so far, what we're really seeing, I think, is the effects of Bitcoin choosing to be a money network. And if this is going to work out, I think we need more data. I think we need about 10 to 20 more years of data, honestly, to make some decisions here. And Bitcoin hopefully is around long enough to make decisions like that. But this is a very small amount of fees derived from transactions that are going to miners. And right now, miners would love more of these fees, but they're not going to get them because people are hodling their Bitcoin and not really spending it. Any final thoughts on that? Well, I guess we're staying on a very similar topic for the next slide.
Yeah, so we've got one more chart on fees here. So this will sort of help contextualize, you know, where these fees are actually coming from. And of course, you know, if Bitcoin blocks are empty, then there's not really a fee market. There's more space for transactions. So you don't really need to sort of outbid other users for space in that block. So really the main thing that, you know, sort of drives up fee revenue is block fullness. And, you know, if you hop to the next chart, you can kind of see the historic trend of full blocks versus empty blocks. So you can see, you know, in 2021 or 2018, when we actually reached sort of that saturation point of full blocks and there was no more space for transactions, that's when you start to see this fee market actually really develop and fees will absolutely skyrocket from there. So it's sort of a step function change, which I think is pretty interesting. You know, fees are maybe around a dollar right now, but when blocks are full, they can hit as high as $50. So, you know, really the fee market is sort of a function of that. And we're certainly seeing, you know, changes being introduced, like SegWit, I think was a pretty big important change that sort of adjusted the economics of block space. And we're continuing to see lots of changes proposed in the mempool as well with things like replace by fee, which we'll get to a little bit later. But yeah, essentially, this is the main thing to watch is, you know, demand for block space and how that translates into a sort of step function change in the fee market there.
Yeah, I love this chart. And I think it's important to look at for people to understand. The one thing I also want to draw attention to, I think, is at the very right side of that chart, you have that bump in block fullness. I'm assuming that's November of 2022, which is just a few weeks ago when Binance shuffled around some Bitcoin wallets and just paid an absurd fee for all their Bitcoin they're moving around. And that really increased the bottom line rate to settle a transaction on the Bitcoin blockchain. So I like to see how responsive Bitcoin is to fees based on block fullness. It's a pretty cool metric to look at.
Absolutely. And I think this next section here will actually dive a little bit deeper into that Binance sort of consolidation of their cold wallet. So we actually have like a sort of real-time view of the mempool and all the different fee rates in the next chart. So you can see here, as you mentioned, you know, Binance was doing some shuffling of their wallets and ended up broadcasting a bunch of fees in the fee rate range of sort of 12 to 15 sats per V-byte. You know, that's how we measure transaction fees in Bitcoin, is essentially how many Satoshis you're paying per sort of the actual size of the transaction in virtual megabytes. So, yeah, basically, you know, up until that point for the entire, you know, second half of the year, you could pretty easily get into the next Bitcoin block just by broadcasting in the range of 1 to 3 Satoshis per virtual byte. But Binance ended up flooding the entire mempool with a bunch of 12 to 15 sat per V-byte transactions. And as you can see here, that resulted in a pretty substantial spike of the average mining reward, jumping up from around 6.3 to 6.35, all the way up to 6.6. I think there was actually one block during this period where F2 pool netted about 0.73 Bitcoin in transaction fees. I think that was the highest we saw. So yeah, again, you know, while this is really just the result of Binance sort of being inefficient with their transactions, and there probably were better ways to broadcast this that wouldn't resulted in mempool congestion, certainly not a bad thing for miners.
Yeah, definitely not a bad thing for miners. I would be curious from our audience right now if you guys have any thoughts on transaction fees, or if you guys have a takeaway from it. I see some conversation from Dan talking about like Bitcoin as an investment stack, which is definitely sort of, I think, a driver for why you're seeing this data on chain, right? People's decisions on how they're going to invest in Bitcoin and hodl Bitcoin directly correlates to information we see on chain. So I also, going back to the Binance thing here, this pretty wild to see that. It's interesting how they probably just sort of just locked and loaded and then pressed go. And you know, that's why you have like this very high fee. That's interesting to see. It's also interesting to know, so if you use Bitcoin wallets a lot and you're overpaying for fees, well, here's your data you can look at and know if you're overpaying for fees. You don't really need to pay much of a fee to get a transaction included on chain. So look at your preset fees on whatever Bitcoin wallet you are using. Make sure it's selecting the correct fee. We'll keep moving. Now we're talking about replace by fee. Maybe you can give like a little backstory on RBF as well before we dive into this one.
Yeah. So, and we talked about this a little bit more in depth in our recent mining special, but essentially replace by fee is just a sort of unique transaction type that allows you, if you turn it on, to rebroadcast a transaction later, with a higher fee. So let's say, you know, I'm sending you some Bitcoin, Will, I only attach a fee of 1 Satoshi per V byte. But turns out the mempool is really congested. My fee is not getting confirmed in the time expected. If I had replace by fee turned on, I could then rebroadcast that transaction again with a higher fee, let's say 3 to 5 Satoshis per V-byte, and sort of guarantee a faster settlement time because miners are rationally going to pick the higher fee transaction. So, you know, this has been a feature optionally implemented in Bitcoin for some time now. And as you can see in this chart here, we've seen pretty rapid adoption of this transaction type, you know, beginning of 2020, sitting around 5% transactions using RBF. Right around now, we're around 30%. But it's definitely controversial because the feature can also be abused. Essentially, if you have a zero confirmation transaction, you can effectively reverse that transaction by rebroadcasting it and attaching that higher fee. But instead of sending it to you, Will, I could say, no, send it back to me. So, you know, this has generated a lot of controversy because in Bitcoin Core 24.0, RBF is going basically from optional to the default option for node mempools. And a lot of sort of merchant community members have pushed back on this because they think it increases the risk of chargeback fraud. And yeah, I included a screenshot here, which I think kind of highlights, you know, sort of the different ways of thinking here. Essentially, my proposition was for miners, it doesn't really matter as long as there's increased fees. You know, they're going to be earning more revenues. But this is a tweet from the CEO of BitRefill, which is obviously one of the bigger sort of, you know, payment facilitators in the Bitcoin community. And his thinking is that because these on-chain transactions are going to offer, you know, sort of an inferior user experience now, because you can't offer zero confirmation transactions safely anymore in Bitcoin, This is going to result in less on-chain transactions and therefore less fee revenue for miners. So pretty interesting viewpoint. Definitely looking to dig into the data a little bit more on, you know, whether RBF transactions actually represent more fees for miners, or if it is the case that this is going to result in less on-chain transactions, especially for sort of these retail payment types. But yeah, sort of a interesting bit of controversy that's happening in the broader Bitcoin community that's also trickling over into mining here.
For sure. The one comment I have on this is it's interesting to see merchants who use Bitcoin, miners who are mining Bitcoin, and developers who are maintaining or adding features to the Bitcoin network all work together and have conversations around this. And I think RBF is a great case study to enjoy. Let's move over to Poulin, though. Bitcoin mining pool has some trouble this year. Not only a pool, but also a self-mining firm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so this was a topic we covered a little bit in our Q3 report as it was sort of unfolding. Obviously, that's when the initial withdrawal pause and collapse happened. But there have been a few developments that I want to point out in the time since. So yeah, essentially this here shows sort of a map of Poulin's mining dominance over the last few years through 2021 and 2022. And as you can see, you know, they were a top 10, top five even mining pool, mining around 20 blocks per day at the beginning of 2021. They did experience a little bit of turbulence after China banned Bitcoin mining. They were, a China Asia-based sort of mining pool. So you saw a significant drop in Poulin blocks after that China ban. And then sometime after, they began briefly masking their mining signature. For the viewers who aren't familiar, how we sort of identify this in the Coinbase signature, where miners are rewarding themselves the transaction for finding the block, they tend to leave a miner signature that says Poulin.com or AntPool or F2Pool, whatever mining pool mined the block. They tend to leave a little signature. But for a brief time in late 2021, Poulin began masking the signature and signing blocks as XXXXXX.com. But later in 2022, they began using their standard Poulin.com block signature again. And you know, things seemed to be pretty normal. They continued mining at a rate of 15 to 20 blocks per day. Up until around August, September, they announced that they were pausing withdrawals for their pool, which is really not what you want to see. You don't want to see pools taking on any additional liquidity risk. They should be just mining the blocks and sending those rewards to their miners. But unfortunately, as a result of this withdrawal freeze, Poulin's dominance as a mining pool has plummeted substantially, going from about 15 blocks per day to, I mean, two or three at the most in recent months. So that's pretty much what we see here is that big drop in Poulin dominance. And, what you can see in this next chart is essentially how that translates into revenue. And, you know, part of this picture here is that Poulin was actually in trouble well before they froze withdrawals, just due to the decline in Bitcoin price. Going from revenues around, 4 to 6 million a day to around 2 million a day just before they froze withdrawals. This just represents the actual rewards earned by miners themselves. For Poulin, their fee is 2.5%. So that's around 25,000 for every 1 million in daily miner revenue. And you can see, again, this has just been a massive fall from grace. They're actually learning less in miner revenue than they were earning in just transaction fees in early 2021, which I also thought was pretty interesting. So
that's wild. That's wild.
And then another thing we've got plotted out here, sort of speculation around what happened to Poulin, could have been related to some of their experiments in DeFi. This graph here shows the price chart for PBTC35A, which was essentially Poulin's hash rate token that represented, one terahash in sort of revenues. You could buy this and you would earn wrapped Bitcoin, I believe, and it sort of acted as a hash rate derivative. But through 2022, we've seen this price of this hash rate derivative fall around 97%. So, if Poulin was using this as collateral or depending on it in any substantial way, you can definitely see how this sort of derivative could result in insolvency issues for Poulin.
is tokenized hash rate products always seem to collapse at some point or another. I tracked this token for a good while. And if you go back to the China mining ban, it also suffered some issues there because the token is tied to a basket of hash rate, which is Poulin's own self-mining. And then they tokenize it and ship it around. It trades on a peer-to-peer market or just on a secondary market, I should say. And people speculated that Poulin was having some trouble, especially with what's going on with their pool itself. And I think they start punishing the token for that, even if the hash rate is still there in some cases, just because it's on a secondary market. But to me, this looks like yet another failed Uniswap token, just battered into the ground. Let's keep moving on with Poulin, though.
Yeah, so some of the newer developments since sort of the Q3 collapse, just recently I took a look at the actual inflows and outflows of any mining pool address associated with Poulin. Again, naturally what you want to see is approximately an equal amount of inflows from the block reward and outflows as miners withdraw their rewards. And for most of 2022, you saw that. But of course, right around the time where they froze withdrawals, you saw a pretty big uptick in inflows as they continued to mine but weren't processing withdrawals. And naturally, they've seen a collapse in both inflows and outflows since they froze this withdrawals. But what I found pretty interesting is just last month, we saw a massive set of outflows from these addresses, around 400 Bitcoin per day, leaving those addresses to the tune of around 10,000 Bitcoin. And this was just last month. So if we hop over to the next slide here, we'll see where those flows actually went. It looks like it basically went from one of Poulin's main zero hop addresses to a set of three other addresses, around 3,000 Bitcoin each over this time period. So I've done a little bit of investigation of these addresses, not really clear who they're controlled by. Maybe somebody bailed them out. Maybe they're controlled by Poulin or Poulin self-mining operations, but just another interesting development in the Poulin saga, sort of identifying who controls these addresses that now hold the majority of Poulin's sort of holdings. And one other development here that I noticed is recently we've also seen Poulin begin mining not to their own zero hop addresses, but to Antpool's addresses. So to me, this suggests that, maybe there's a deeper relationship than most of us are aware of between Antpool and Poulin. Perhaps Antpool could have stepped in to sort of supplement their liquidity. But just since the beginning of November, we've begun to see inflows of around 20 to 30 Bitcoin per day mined by Poulin in blocks that are signed by Poulin, but deposited directly to Antpool's addresses. So again, not really sure what's going on here. What's the relationship between Antpool and Poulin? Maybe, I'm just not aware of some, deeper historical relationship, but certainly, smells like a bailout to me.
Interesting. So I'll add some speculation to this. And again, it is speculation, but a big issue that Poulin actually came up across, and I think it might be why they've been having so much troubles and basically collapses, not only the failure to pay the pool payouts, but they had a huge site in Texas that was not able to get online in time. I think it was about 800 megawatts was supposed to be the entire size of it. And they purchased a bunch of Antminer pools, like the big hydro containers, very expensive. And they finished the farm, right? It was completely done. They were posting about it on their Twitter account. Their CEO was posting about it. They had a big ribbon cutting ceremony and it was hooked up, ready to go. But ERCOT did not approve it to go online, and so they had to wait. And every day they were taking damages against the site for having to pay off those miners and pay off all that machinery, the equipment, the infrastructure, but they weren't getting any Bitcoin back. And I think they needed that site to go online in order to supplement what they had lost during the China mining ban, but also to pay off possibly debts or keep the business running against high difficulty. And I just don't think that came to pass because of what happened with ERCOT, because ERCOT was a little slower in getting them on the grid for whatever their reasons were. And at the same time, you saw Poulin shut off its pool. You saw issues here with what you're showing now, the Antpool is coming in. And you also saw liquidations of all those assets at that Texas site. Or to my knowledge, a lot of those assets were sold off to different mining companies. So I think this is some really interesting data here that we have to show that, yes, Poulin has a basically liquidated almost everything. I'd expect maybe some more information from them going into the new year about what their plans are next, because their pool is technically still alive And like you show here, there's still some data showing that something is active. I wouldn't be surprised, and this is just speculation, I wouldn't be surprised if Antpool or someone purchased those liquidated assets from this Texas site and then started mining to the same configurations because they just didn't change anything. And they just changed the payout address to Antpool itself. And we know that Antpool and Bitmain have this interesting relationship that's supposed to be different, but in some cases, maybe not. So there's some speculation in there as well. Maybe Poolin wasn't able to pay off the equipment it purchased. And so Antpool just snagged it and started paying, mining itself. But we'll move on to the next subject here, mining pools.
Yeah. So, of course, you know, the Poolin debacle is kind of just one interesting anecdote that's happened this year. But really, we've seen some pretty dramatic changes in the entire mining pool landscape throughout the year, Poolin included. So the next chart essentially just shows the share of mining pool dominance for all mining pools. And obviously, with the collapse of Poolin, we've seen, you know, all of that hash rate sort of be absorbed by other players. So I don't know if you're able to hop to the next slide here. Yeah. And as you can see, you know, the primary beneficiaries of, you know, sort of this collapse in Poolin would be the top three mining pools. So we've seen, Foundry, Antpool, and F2Pool, the top three mining pools, gain a substantial amount of share in the last year. You know, I think Foundry became the number one mining pool somewhere around the beginning of this year. And since they've managed to sort of hold that foothold, you know, well above 20 to 25% of hash rate on a day-to-day basis pretty consistently. And, you know, while it's great to see sort of a shakeup in the pool landscape because it shows, you know, miners can redirect their hash rate anywhere, I don't love to see these top two to three pools getting such a large share. You know, as you can see, the top three control well above 50% of the mining pool hash rate. And, you know, even just the top two are starting to near that threshold. So, again, while it's healthy to have sort of these, you know, collapses due to leverage, I would like to see the hash rate redirected maybe to smaller pools going forward.
Yeah, two comments on this. One, Foundry just dominant ever since our introduction to the scene. They run many different services, pool services being one among them. And I think it's because they offer a payout that is immediate based on your hash rate. And then also they're really courting a lot of these public miners. So like a lot of the public hash rate is just going to this one pool. There's some other mining companies that have tried to boot up their own pools. Terra Pool will be one of those that didn't work out too well. Mara Pool is also in existence and that seems to be doing pretty well. But the reason you often don't use your own pool is because then you have bad luck and then you don't get your Bitcoin payouts and then investors don't like that. So a lot of these public miners are moving towards the largest pool. They have an incentive to go towards the largest pool because they need that USD at the end of the day, not that Bitcoin. And a story to back that up is Riot moving off of Brains, possibly to Foundry. We don't know who yet, but more than likely Foundry, just because Brains had a really bad month in November. It was very unlucky and they didn't mine as much Bitcoin as the hash rate they had under management. So I think that just continues to put pressure on the Bitcoin network, the fact that public miners are moving towards one centralized pool like Foundry, which is, as you said, about 30% of the hash rate. Second point, F2Pool, interesting to see continued dominance, one of the older pools in Bitcoin. And I do think that they've soaked up a lot of the hash rate from Chinese miners who maybe left Poolin, maybe left Antpool, maybe left via BTC, some of these China pools that dried up or disappeared after the China mining ban. Last comment, I guess I'll throw out there is we still see some nice movement with the Brains team. Luxor moved into a very great position over this last year. And there's been a few other pool projects that have been trying to get some attention. During the bull market, though, it's time to grow. Bear market is time to survive. So we'll see who can make it through the next few years until the next happening. Let's move on to the next slide here, though.
Yeah. So, you know, to your point about, you know, very large miners like Riot shifting from Brains to Foundry, you know, I think a big dynamic at play here is, again, the pool payout structures. So Foundry, for example, offers, like you said, full pay per share. Essentially, you know, no matter whether they actually mine a block or not, they're going to compensate you according to what's the fair value of your hash rate, sort of on a global average. So again, whether a block is mined or not, you're getting paid. Whereas a pool like Brains, you know, they use sort of a pay per last end shares. Essentially, you're only getting paid out if Brains actually mines a block. And, you know, during times where they're lucky, that might be a little bit better. You're getting a little bit more upside. But during times where they're not mining blocks, you don't get that consistent revenue. So I think, you know, the pool payout structure is going to be super relevant. And one thing that kind of factors in here is the amount of empty blocks mined by the pool as well, because the pools are absorbing all this risk when they're using this full pay per share model. They're paying you out whether or not there are actually transaction fees, you know, being earned by the pool. And so a big sort of competitive factor here as well is the pool's ability to actually get transactions into a block. For the audience members who aren't familiar with empty blocks, in the time after a block is mined, pools will begin working on the next block, but sometimes they don't have time to actually assemble a block template that contains transactions. So in those split seconds after a block is mined, there's a small chance of an empty block being mined because the mining pool hasn't assembled that transaction bearing template. But even though Foundry is the number one, you know, mining pool, this year they actually haven't mined any empty blocks. They've been able to consistently piece together a template containing transaction fees and sort of earn all their miners that fee revenue. So I think, you know, it's really interesting. You see full pay per share pools like Foundry and Luxor that are absorbing this risk, but they're also doing really well in assembling those transaction templates and earning those fee revenues versus some of the pools like ViaBTC or Binance Pool aren't quite as effective in terms of assembling those templates. And I think it'll also be very interesting as Stratum V2 is rolled out because, you know, at that point, miners are going to have the ability to assemble those transaction templates themselves. So that could certainly shake up sort of the mining pool landscape as well, just the ability of miners to assemble their own templates. But just another sort of competitive dynamic to look at between the mining pools is how effective are they at actually assembling those blocks and earning those transaction fees.
Yeah, I love this. Maybe because I'm a little tech nerdy, but I think it's cool to look at how Bitcoin miners have a little bit more work than people think about than just hash rate. Like these pools also have to build these templates, and then these blocks need to be propagated to the network. And if there's any snags in that whole process, well, you might not get that Bitcoin. And this is going to become more and more important as Bitcoin appreciates in value over the next 10 to 20 years, right? If you mess up because your pool software was incorrect, well, guess what? You just lost out on a ton of revenue. So you have to get this software correct. And on top of that, Stratum V2, this is, I think, definitely going to change the block template game. So we'll see how these numbers look maybe next year from now, though. Stratum V2, we'll see when everything sort of rolls out. It's always like quite there, right? There's always some headline about it. Right.
Yeah. And one thing on top of that, that I think is interesting as well is, again, you know, like you said, it's a lot more work than you might realize to assemble a block. You got to be constantly monitoring the mempool, looking for these transactions. And then, of course, we have this new dynamic with replace by fee. So not only are miners, you know, going to have to assemble their block templates in time, but they're also going to have to stay on top of whether fees have been rebroadcast with increased transaction fees. So, yeah, definitely a lot more work than people realize in terms of assembling these block templates and earning sort of the highest fee revenues possible. But yeah, we'll leave it there.
Well, actually, one more thought. We're in mining nerds, so we got to talk about it. It is interesting. Foundry has its own pool service. To my knowledge, a lot of that stuff is often built by the same people. And so it's interesting to see how like one pool software provider will build something and then other people will use it and then see from the data who's the most proficient at it. I can't remember off the top of my head who built Foundries, if it was in-house or if it was from a second party or a third party, I should say. But I know that I'm pretty sure it was a third party. I can't remember who it was though. And so you get different efficiencies based on like who built your software, and that turns into revenue, right? So like put some money into whatever software you're using. Okay, we'll leave it there and we'll go to the last bit of our show today, one hop analysis.
Yeah, so this is always a fun sort of analysis to revisit. Again, it's just, you know, a basic heuristic for approximating the number of miners in the network, yeah, you know, and what are those flows and supply held by those miners. So again, just as a reminder, you know, we have our zero hop addresses, which are addresses that are credited directly with new issuance from the Bitcoin blockchain. Those tend to be mining pools. And then one-hop addresses are any address that is sort of one payment removed from a zero-hop address. And so that tends to be individual miners who are contributing their hash rate to a pool and receiving payouts minus pool fees directly from that zero-hop address. And so looking at the one-hop address set, again, it's a pretty good gauge for looking at the amount of miners that are actually engaged with these mining pools. There's some nuance, again, around, you know, pool payout structures. But we can think of one-hop addresses as sort of a good heuristic for looking at the active Bitcoin miners. And so what this chart shows is essentially the number of active Bitcoin miner addresses, number of active one-hop addresses on a month-to-month basis. And you can see this maps pretty closely to sort of speculative bull and bear cycles. We see the number of active miner addresses peak generally right around the time or right after Bitcoin price spikes. For example, in 2018, we saw the number of active miner addresses go from a bottom of around 15,000 all the way up to 80,000 active miners. So again, we can kind of see this relationship between the number of people who are interested in mining and Bitcoin price, of course. A couple of things I think are interesting about the most recent trend is, even though we saw Bitcoin price run up substantially in 2021 and 2022, we did not see sort of the same rapid increase in Bitcoin mining addresses, possibly due to, you know, sort of the consolidation of hash power into a smaller set of publicly traded entities. But either way, we've seen a substantial decrease in the number of active miner addresses since reaching highs earlier this year. We've fallen about 50% in terms of the number of active miners. So again, maybe this means miners have capitulated and we found some sort of bottom here. But we're definitely starting to see a pretty big drop off in the number of miners on the network.
Yeah, it'd be interesting just to riff some ideas, like whiteboard some ideas why the number of addresses has fallen. Like I read this in the Save Network when you guys published this, I think about a week or two ago, and have put a little bit of thought into it. And the China mining ban, definitely one thing I'm thinking about, like how did Chinese miners use addresses? Did they flip through them a lot? Did they shuffle addresses or not too much? And then also like how people use addresses in Bitcoin, right? So typically you're supposed to swap addresses pretty frequently or as much as possible and then consolidate U2XOs later just in order to protect your own privacy. And I wonder how much that is a cause in what we're looking at right here. Probably not a lot, because I think it's pretty standard. Most people just like don't do a lot of that. And I like your explanation lastly that, you know, public companies derive a lot of the hash rate, right? So they're not going to use a lot of addresses. We typically have almost every public company's Bitcoin address, and we can just look at it and see what they're doing every single day. And they're all paying to the same address. So this is certainly an interesting one, though, because if you look back to that 2012, late 2012, a lot of public addresses or a lot of active addresses, and then it's piddled out quite a lot. And a lot of that has to do with the advent of ASICs as well, right? So a little bit more functionality, programmability with these things. So it makes sense. Yeah. Any final thoughts on this chart?
Yeah, I think I'll just echo what you said. You know, you can't just flip on your computer and start mining anymore. You have to have specialized equipment and specialized facilities. So naturally, there's going to be a consolidation. And, you know, I agree. There definitely could be other reasons for sort of the collapse in active mining addresses related to bad privacy practices, for example. Maybe people are just getting worse about reusing addresses. So definitely something I'm hoping to dig into the future and, you know, sort of perform maybe some address clustering and see if that's the case. But yeah, lots of interesting areas for research going forward here.
Definitely. Parker, thank you so much for assembling all that. For everyone who's listening to stream later or right now, check out Coinmetrics' State of the Network newsletter. Go subscribe to it by going to coinmetrics.com or to their Twitter account. It's probably the best data. Parker's going to say it's the best. I'm going to say probably. There's one or two out there that I really like. But Coinmetrics puts out amazing data. Go subscribe to their data or go use their public data and check out some information about Bitcoin while you're on your Christmas or holiday vacation. Parker, thank you again for your time today. Where can we find you on the internet and follow you?
I'm generally, you know, on Twitter. So, at Parker Merritt, and of course, yeah, follow at Coinmetrics as well. Subscribe to all the newsletters, State of the Network, State of the Market. We've got a lot of great content coming your way. So appreciate you having me on, Will.
For sure. And for everyone who's watching, thank you for tuning in with us. Leave a comment below if you have any questions or things that we didn't get to that you want some follow-up on. We'll be doing a very similar but different topics with the hash rate index team at the beginning of the year to round up 2022 and a forward looking for 2023. So maybe we can cover those topics if you have a question we didn't get to today. Though I must say, today was pretty holistic. Be sure to subscribe to the Compass Mining channel. We put out different podcasts every single week, about 2 to 3 mining specific podcasts. So if you're into that, give us a follow here on YouTube or check us out on our podcast as well, the Mining Pod. But from everyone at Compass and from Coinmetrics, thanks for tuning in with us today. We'll see you later and have a great vacation.